helping to secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity. This is the Constitution Study on the America Out Loud Network with your host, Paul Engel. You know, I believe everybody is good at something. There's something that we're just intuitively able to do. I always use the example of my cousin. I have a cousin who is extremely mechanically inclined. At the age of 5, he completely disassembled his mother's vacuum cleaner. That's not entirely, you know, special. But when she warned him, wait till your father gets home, by the time his father had gotten home, he had reassembled the vacuum cleaner and it still worked. So even at the age of 5, he understood mechanical. Me, not so much. I understand in theory how they work. Don't ask me to fix your car. Me, on the other hand, computers. I understand them intuitively. Like I said, I had a 30-year IT career. So I believe there's something that we are all good at. There's something in your life that you're good at. You may not know what it is, and it may not even be the thing that you're good at is actually a good thing. I mean, you could be a good thief. You could be a good embezzler. Doesn't necessarily mean that the thing is good, but you're good at it. And just because you're good at it doesn't mean the thing is good. Well, take, for example, governments. Now, some people treat government, especially the federal government, as an unmitigated good. You want to protect people from bad products? Create a government agency. You want to avoid another bank collapse? Let government regulate it. You want some open spaces for the people to enjoy? Create a park and put government in charge. But there is one almost universal truth that those who trust government to regulate every aspect of their lives seem to have forgotten. See, the one thing governments across history have proven to be very good at is screwing things up. Hello there, everyday Americans. Paul Engel here with the Constitution Study, where we read and study the Constitution. We teach the rising generation to be free. I'm glad you could join me today. Now, for those out there that are going to complain that, you know, I'm anti-government, no, I think government is a necessary evil. I think the idea of putting people in charge of the lives of other people is sometimes necessary, but because of it's the fact that we're dealing with people in government, those people are fallen. Contrary to what some believe, we are not naturally good. Just look at any child. You'll see they're naturally bad. You don't have to teach a child to lie. And if you look at the world around us, without societal pressure, we tend to devolve into treating each other, well, really pretty nastily. So what happens when we take some of those people and we put them in governments? Well, if you don't put bounds around them, our founding fathers understood that if you don't put restrictions on what they can do, well, they quickly turn that evil human intent into the acclimation of power to actually screw things up for the American people. Now, sure, there are many examples. I want to get to a few of them today. But I want you to understand, it's not that we don't need government, but because the acclimation of power, because government entities tend to draw people who are interested in power, those powers must be chained down. They must be bounded, they must be restricted, and those restrictions must be put in force. Otherwise, you let loose a whirlwind without any way to rein it back in. So let's take, for example, public parks, right? I mean, granted, I live in the country. If I want to see wilderness, if I want to see nature, I go outside my front door. I intentionally live far from cities because I like living that way. But I understand, you know, I still live in New York City. And having a park, a place of nature to go to, is a good thing. So we have city parks. I have no problem with that. We have state parks. Okay, I'm a little more concerned only because, again, we're moving control farther and farther away from the people. But what about national parks? See, there's a couple of very interesting things. Article 1, Section 8, Clause 17 of the Constitution says that Congress has the power to exercise exclusive legislation in all cases whatsoever over such district, not exceeding 10 miles square, as may by secession of the particular states and the acceptance of Congress become the seat of government of the United States, and to exercise like authority over all places purchased by the consent of the legislature of the state in which the same shall be for the erection of forts, magazines, arsenals, dockyards, and other needful buildings. Do you see parks in there anywhere? No. First of all, the land needs to be purchased from the state at the consent of the legislature. Second, they should only be there for a few things: to put in forts, magazines, arsenal, dockyards, and other needful buildings. So when the federal government buys a chunk of land and establishes a new fort, that's constitutional. When they put in magazines or arsenals for storing weapons and munitions, that's constitutional. Dockyards for ships, for the Navy, that's constitutional. Even buildings like, federal courthouses and other buildings that are needed for the different legitimate departments and agencies, that's constitutional. But nowhere in there does it say anything about national parks. Now, I know it was Teddy Roosevelt, a Republican, by the way, loved the idea of nature and thought, you know what, let's let the federal government gobble up vast tracts of land and turn them into nature preserves that we'll call national parks. Unconstitutional, illegal, he got away with it anyway. And today, we have four different federal land management agencies. You have the Bureau of Land Management, you have Fish and Wildlife Service, you have the National Park Service, and the Department of the Interior. Oh, and let's not forget the Forest Service, which is part of the Department of Agriculture. Another agency, the Department of Defense, administers roughly 9 million acres in the United States for the military bases, training ranges, and whatever. So of the four non-military agencies, they administer roughly 606.5 million acres of land. Over 600 million acres. Now, imagine how big is 600 million acres. Well, it's approximately 1/4 of the U.S. landmass. In other words, the federal government illegally manages roughly 25% of the landmass of the United States. Think about that. Now, again, I was born in the East. I still live east of the Mississippi, where the percentages in each state are relatively small. But you get out to the western U.S., the federal government owns 60, 70, 80% of the landmass of some of the western states. So, okay, we've put government, but we want these national parks. We think they're pretty. We like being able to go visit them. What's wrong with this? Well, there are a lot of problems with it. One of the problems is the Forestry Service decided that, you know what? We have to stomp out each and every fire as soon as we find it. Now, I guess initially that made sense, right? Because fires burn forests. And when fires burn forests, well, they get damaged. We don't want to damage our property. You don't want a fire in your house. You see a fire in the kitchen, you don't let it burn for a while. But we're not talking about a house. We're talking about a forest. And it was only later that we realized, hey, you know what? Fire is part of the natural life cycle of forests. Fires burn down the lower brush, the smaller trees, without damaging the big trees. Several trees actually require fire to propagate. I think it's the redwoods. It requires fire to open the cones so that they can propagate. So by letting the government decide, this is what we're going to do, we're going to contradict nature, and we're going to put our own ideas on it, we ended up not with these small fires that did minimal damage in rural areas. No, we ended up with these monster fires. These fire storms that not only burnt the undergrowth, burnt the underbrush, but burnt the mature trees, laying waste to square miles of land. And in doing so, putting millions of people's lives at risk. That was an obvious one. But the Foundation for Economic Education found something that was a little interesting. See, they published an article where they say in their research that across America, there are roughly 15 million acres of state and federal land that is surrounded by private land without any easement, without any way to actually get onto this state and federal land. Now, if you're a property owner, you may be familiar with the idea of an easement, but if you're not, it's the legal right of someone else to enter your property. For example, I have a home on my land. The electric company, the telephone company, has poles and wires to get from the road, which is public land, to my home on my private land. They have an easement. They have a legal right to come onto my property within the area next to the poles to do repair work, to do inspections, right? That's an easement. Some of you may be familiar with it in a different standpoint. If you have what they call a landlocked piece of land, in other words, if you own property that is surrounded by other people's private property on all sides, you need an easement. You need a legal right to be able to get onto your property. That would be negotiated with one of the other neighbors. Well, it appears the federal government and state governments, they never thought of that. There are 15, now again, we're talking about 15 million acres. If I understand that correctly, if all that land was contiguous, if you took all 15 million acres and put it all together, it would be almost the size of Vermont, New Hampshire, and Connecticut combined. At least that's according to the New York Times. Now, in another article from the Times, the only reason this land was discovered was because some guy made an app that he wanted to take the idea of Google Maps. He wanted to make something similar, but for wilderness areas. So where Google Maps looks mostly at populated areas, he wanted an effective Google Maps for the wilderness. And in doing this, because he works part-time as a hunting guide in Montana, in doing this, he found out about all these plots of land that are state or federally owned, but with no legal access to it. Now, I don't know about you, but if the idea of having this state land is to have parks, or even just to preserve the land, you need to have some level of access to it. Now, I want to make something abundantly clear. I'm not saying everybody that works for government is foolish. They're not. The problem is it's an interesting dichotomy. It's that as an individual, you can be very, very smart. But when we put groups together, they tend to get very stupid. Or as I'd heard one person describe it, individuals are smart. People are stupid. See, once you make a bureaucracy, once it's not the decision of a single individual, now it's not so much about making the decision, but it's about covering your backside. The design by committee we hear about, right? The idea that when you look at design, so where did that come from? Well, it was designed by committee. You had dozens or hundreds of people, each lobbying for their own point of view on different aspects and having to compromise. Now, whenever you're dealing with government, compromise is kind of the name of the game. But think about it. When governments regulate, when governments control, when the bureaucracy is the one making the decisions, when we ignore, who is it, FDR? Or is it, no, it's Teddy Roosevelt. That's one of them said, the buck stops here. The idea that no matter what happens, it was ultimately one person's responsibility to get something done. When that is lost, when nobody is responsible for anything, when everybody is responsible for everything, nothing ever gets done right. Now, that may be a bit of an exaggeration because, even a blind squirrel can find a nut every so often. Even a broken clock is correct twice a day. But when we put our futures in the hands of other people, they don't necessarily have our best interests in heart. And even if the individuals do, they're working with a bureaucratic framework that does not have our best interests at heart. So we really need to look at what's been going on lately and ask ourselves, is this just government screwing things up again? And if so, why would we give them the power to do it to us one more time? Now, before I get there, I'm going to ask you to do a couple things. One, I want you to head over to the website constitutionstudy.com. It's the main website for the Constitution Study. It's where I post my articles, my videos, and guess what? You can ask a question there. I love answering questions. I just got one the other day that I'm turning into an article that'll publish here in a little while. But you can ask a question. You can ask me to answer it on the radio. Just find the Ask a Question button on the menu at constitutionstudy.com. You can also sign up for one of my mailing lists. I'm working on a new program here at the Constitution Study. One, well, that I'm designing to help encourage people to get better educated, better communicated, better activated to protect their own freedom. I truly believe the evidence is abundant that if we're going to save the Republic, it's not going to be done in Washington, D.C. And it's not directly going to be done at our state houses. It's going to start in our backyards, with our neighborhoods, our counties, and our cities. And I'm working on a program to help. So sign up for the mailing list and you'll get notified as I develop this program and as it becomes available. But I'd also like you to check out HealthyCell.com. See, HealthyCell is a leading innovator in supplements designed to work at the cellular level. Now, one of the best things you can do to live a healthy life is to make sure your immune system's up to snuff. Now, the Immune Super Boost supports your immune system while you're on the go with immune-boosting nutrients in a single to easy-to-use travel-ready gel pack. It combines over a dozen supplements to help keep your immune system going. Now, as an America Out Loud listener, you get 25% off your first order at HealthyCell.com. Just put your order together and use the code OUTLOUD. So please, go to HealthyCell.com, check out any of their great products, not just the Immune Super Boost. They've got some wonderful products, and my family uses them regularly. But make sure you use that code out loud at checkout. It lets them know you listen to America Out Loud, and as a thank you, you get 25% off your first order.
Let's get real, let's get loud on America Loud Talk Radio. And I'm Dr. Peter McCullough. I have to tell you that I think one of the biggest advances in nutraceuticals and supplements is HealthyCell. And the HealthyCell line is extensive. I typically focus on the microgel technology, three major products here, Immune Super Boost, the Focus and Recall, and then the REM sleep supplement. Each one of these is complementary and they can have a role, I think, in the health of your life each and every day. I know they do in my case. Many of you know, after COVID-19 twice, I spent almost the entire year in 2022 with an upper respiratory tract illness. Now, thankfully, I'm through the first 2 months of 2023 and I've been diligent with the Immune Super Boost in the morning, followed by Focus and Energy, and then in the evening time, the REM sleep supplement. The microgel technology works, and boy, does it work fast. So go to our website, America Out Loud Talk Radio, find the banner bar for HealthyCell, click on it, and that'll take you to the site to get a discount on your purchase of all HealthyCell products. So let's get real, let's get loud on America Out Loud Talk Radio.
Trouble concentrating or recalling information is frustrating, embarrassing, and kills productivity. Nutrition company HealthyCell created Focus and Recall to boost your brain power. Unlike other supplements that don't work, Focus and Recall is not a pill. It's a gel you swallow with ultra absorption of science-backed ingredients to help you immediately sharpen focus, concentrate longer, and strengthen recall. Go to HealthyCell.com and use code OUTLOUD for 25% off your first order. Risk-free. Love it or your money back. Guaranteed. HealthyCell.com. Code out loud.
Welcome back, everyday Americans. You've rejoined the Constitution Study, and today we're looking at how the one thing governments are really good at is screwing things up. Now, a lot of people like to say, I told you so. Other people just say, it's deja vu all over again. Because when you see the same thing over and over again, and nobody learns their lesson, well, that was Einstein's definition of insanity. Take, for example, Silicon Valley Bank. Now, those of you who were around through the 2008 housing crisis, we're told that, well, the greedy banks made this a mess, so we must regulate them more. Of course, it completely ignored the fact that bank regulators at the federal government had coerced banks into making riskier and riskier loans. They had shielded them from the consequences by buying them up in these quasi-governmental agencies, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. That they had basically removed the liability from the bank and with it any incentive to actually make good loans. And with more and more political pressure to have more and more mortgages to people who are less and less qualified, the federal government was at least partially to blame for the crisis. Now, the banks were part of it too. I'm not saying they had nothing to do with it. They took these garbage mortgages and found more and more creative ways to hide the garbage, and it eventually made people sick. So they come along and say, we're going to Dodd-Frank. We're going to, you know, the two, I think they're both members of the House, or one, you know, Dodd may have been in the Senate. They came up with this legislation to regulate the banking industry, as if it wasn't already one of the most regulated industries in the nation. That they would go through stress tests, and they would do, to me, two of the dumbest things in the world. One, they defined banks that were too big to fail. As soon as you identify something as too big to fail, the moral hazard is that they have no reason to regulate themselves because the government will always come in and back them up. And the other was thinking that a bunch of politicians and bureaucrats have any clue how to make a bank work. So here we have Dodd-Frank. We have, 15 years now, almost 15 years of Dodd-Frank, of these banking regulations that were supposed to prevent anything like the 2008 housing crisis from ever happening again. And along comes Silicon Valley Bank. Now think about it. The Silicon Valley Bank had a board of directors. They had a management team that were supposed to manage the bank. But they also had bank regulators that were looking over their shoulders because this is a large bank. This is one of the largest banks in the country. And the federal regulators and state regulators were supposed to be looking at what they're doing. And none of them, not the bank regulators, not the state regulators, not the federal regulators, not the board of directors, not their management team, apparently saw what were easily preventable problems that in less than a week destroyed this bank. And remember, the regulators had a mandate specifically to prevent such a disaster. But what did they do? They let SVB grow without any effective controls, without making sure that it was properly capitalized and that capital was divested to prevent it from being subject to a centralized shock. Now, again, some people are saying that SVB grew too quickly. In just 2 years, it went from $71 billion in assets to $211 billion in assets. That's tremendous growth. But you see, while the deposits tripled, these deposits were, how do I say, they were not long-term stable. These were what are called demand deposits, meaning all the customer had to do was demand their money back, like a savings account or a checking account. You had the right to go to the bank and said, give me my money. These weren't long-term savings like certificates of deposit or other savings that had time limits on them where the people couldn't simply come and pull the vast majority of the assets out of the bank. No, these were demand deposits that could easily be withdrawn quickly and dangerously. So once depositors got wind that there were issues, that made me serious issues at SVB, guess what happened? They did the logical, rational thing. If that bank is in trouble, I want my money out of the bank. I've been amazed at the number of people that have claimed, well, it was social media that ran to the collapse. It was all the memes. It was all the social media. No, not really. See, the bank collapsed because it was poorly invested in. All social media did was make it happen quicker. It prevented the bank management and the banking regulators from hiding the depth of the problems at SVB from the depositors. And they went and did what was logical and rational. Now, the other problem we have is, again, SVB is a very large bank. And my problem isn't the fact that it was large. It's the fact that the politicians don't hold these banks accountable. See, first of all, we have the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, a federally created corporation that is supposed to insure deposits of up to $250,000, I think it's per depositor. And the banks, they pay premiums to the FDIC for this insurance. Now, on the one hand, that makes people very comfortable. I will put money in this bank because I know, hey, as long as I don't deposit more than $250,000, if the bank goes belly up, the FDIC will cover me. It'll get me my deposit back, at least on certain accounts. Not all accounts are covered by the FDIC. You know, checking accounts, savings accounts, those are covered by the FDIC. But then what happened? You have Treasury Secretary Yellen going, yes, we're going to cover the insured. Oh, by the way, the federal government is going to pay off the uninsured deposits as well. Now, you may say, oh, great. You know, I had money in that bank. My business had money in that bank. It was well beyond the $250,000. I am so happy that my money's coming back. What you don't realize is all that did was say, if a bank is too large to fail, we no longer have a private banking system. If the federal government is going to simply ignore the law and basically take over any bank that stumbles, we no longer have a private banking system. We have a nationalized banking system with a few private banks that the federal government allows to act, not even really independently. They just aren't directly owned by the federal government, but they could be taken over at a moment's notice simply because, well, if they stumble, if they have a problem. Now, why is that a problem? Well, again, the government's really good at screwing things up. You see, the whole idea of insurance is that not everybody who's insured is going to have a problem at the same time. It's simple logic, right? Everybody buys health insurance. Most people are not going to have catastrophic health issues at the same time. We all buy automobile insurance, but they expect that only a small percentage will actually have a serious damage on the vehicle at the same time. So the FDIC is no different. The FDIC has roughly $128 billion in its insurance fund. It's got $128 billion that it can use to bail out the insured accounts that are at these banks. But the Treasury just said, no, we're not only going to cover the insured, we're going to cover the uninsured accounts. Now I want you to think about that. Imagine you don't have health insurance. You go to the doctor, you order all the most expensive treatments because you know Uncle Sam's going to pick up the bill. Or you buy a car and you don't get auto insurance. And then you have a wreck and your car is destroyed and people are injured and you have liability, but you know the government's going to pick it up for you. But what happens to that $128 billion insurance fund if even a small percentage of the $18 trillion currently deposited in U.S. banks goes belly up? The federal government doesn't have the money to cover this. They don't. But not only have they taken on responsibility they can't cover, again, you have the moral hazard. Why should a bank like SVB or Signature or any of the other banks worry about their investment structure, their deposit structures? Because they know if things get really bad, the feds will bail them out. But it gets even worse than that. Because, and this one I'm a little shaky on, but as I understand it, part of Dodd-Frank meant ensuring that banks had a certain amount of deposits, a certain amount of investments on hand to cover withdrawals. And it had to be, had to do with a percentage of the deposits, something, I don't know, was it fractional reserve banking? They played with the numbers. So what's the big deal with that, Paul? Well, I've heard this. I don't have a reference for it yet. So take this with a grain of salt. But as I understand it, Dodd-Frank basically encouraged all these banks to put those investments that they have to keep on hand to cover withdrawals in the same instruments. In other words, to buy federal debt, federal bonds, right? Now, the problem, as I understand it, with SVB, one of their biggest problems was they were heavily invested in these bonds. And as inflation went up, the Federal Reserve drove the interest rate up, which meant the value of these low interest rate bonds that the bank was holding to cover their deposits became less and less until they were underwater. If that's going to happen to SVB, aren't the investments that other banks are using also going to decrease in value? And how long before more and more banks start becoming illiquid because of the natural consequence of this, of the inflation we're dealing with, because the federal government simply printed trillions of dollars? And oh, by the way, has plans to print trillions more. I'm not saying the federal government is the source of all this problem, but they certainly are a contributing factor. And part of the problem is the idea of one size fits all, of everybody being exactly the same in the exact same situation. Take, for example, parental leave. Now listen, I remember when my daughter was born, I wanted to spend all the time I could with her. It was amazing. I understand the desire, especially for mothers. Yep, dads are different. I understand biology, but especially mothers. And that time is not only important to the mother, it's very important to the child. It's one of the reasons why my wife and I, we understood, we agreed before we even talked about getting pregnant, that before having children, one of us would be home full time. And it was most likely going to be my wife. But the government comes along and says, no, you know what? When you have a child, it really isn't, those first few weeks are important. So we're going to mandate certainly family leave laws. Okay, but we're going to make them exactly the same everywhere, or we're going to try to. For example, I'm reading this article out of The Federalist. According to Rhode Island, the state's paid leave law replaces about 60% of an individual's wage. Now, that sounds great. Hey, babe, 60%, you're not going into work, you can stay home, you can take care of the child. But here's the problem. What about the low-income households? Can they afford to take a 40% pay cut? A study of the family leave laws in California, the actual use is they find that a very small percentage of the lowest income earners, those below $20,000 a year, only about 1% of those workers use the state's family leave program. Do you know who uses it the most? Those in the highest income bracket. Those who make over $84,000 a year were five times more likely to use paid family leave than those in the lowest income bracket. Now here's the question. If a one-size-fits-all doesn't work at the state level, what about the federal level? See, the problem with one-size-fits-all means it doesn't really fit anybody. It also forces out other possibilities, flexible work opportunities, different negotiated tools. For, you know, could an expectant mother take overtime and then use that as the as vacation days for her time at home and not lose the income, just divert it till later, or possibly the use of tax deferred savings accounts in order to help people save money so that they can afford to spend time and maybe spend even more time off. Or what about the possibility of an employer offering as a benefit package, flexible time off for child rearing? Maybe turn around and say, you know what? You have a choice. Take your pick. Would you prefer a higher salary, or would you prefer a more of a time off package based on your needs? See, the problem with we keep thinking that bureaucrats in Washington and our state houses, they have all the answers. They know the best way to do this. And it's been my experience that 99% of the time, they absolutely do not. And even from my own experience, making the choices that gave me the maximum flexibility when it came to taking care of my family, well, it's paid off quite well in the long run. It allowed me to spend time with my daughter. It allowed me to provide wealth for my family, to put money away for future medical issues, and to enjoy the life that I wanted to leave, the way I wanted to live it, and not be forced into a certain process simply because, well, some government bureaucrat thinks that's the best way to do things. Now, I have to take a break. And before I do that, I want to remind you, not everybody's going to agree with what I have to say here. That's fine. The Constitution is just one of many voices at America Out Loud. It's the idea of freedom of speech, freedom of press, which is why I go to AmericaOutLoud.com every day to find out what's going on, to get different points of view from different people, among other places. So why don't you do the same thing? Go to AmericaOutLoud.com. Find the stories, the articles, the podcasts, and the videos that encourage you or that infuriate you, and then share them. Let other people know the rest of the story, as Pearl Harbor used to say. And by doing so, you help to secure the blessings of liberty.
We know you love the versatility and portability of the Genesis Fogger, but sometimes you just want to set it and forget it. Well, we heard you. Introducing the UX4 HOCL Atomizer. This stationary unit quietly protects you and is perfect for smaller spaces. With over 250,000 units sold in Japan, it's now available in the United States. Visit genesisfogger.com/outloud to see the UX4 in action and receive a 15% discount on either Fogger with promo code OUTLOUD. With Genesis, you're ready for anything.
You wouldn't go a day without brushing your teeth or washing your hands. What about washing your nose? I mean, your nose does filter the air you breathe. Air loaded with bacteria, viruses, and irritants. Make nasal hygiene part of your routine with Clear. No messy bottles to fill, no drowning sensation. Clear is a natural drug-free saline with the added benefit of xylitol, which blocks bacterial and viral adhesion. Available in stores and online at clear.com. That is X-L-E-A-R.com.
America Out Loud beats to the pulse of our nation. We know when you're angry, you're troubled, confused, glad, and thankful. Well, we know you because we are you. AmericaOutLoud.com. Join us as we explore the most important issues of our time. America Out Loud Talk Radio. Liberty and justice for all.
Welcome back, everyday Americans. If you're joining the Constitution study, today we're looking at how governments generally screw things up. Yeah, we've looked at the land management, out, especially out west. We looked at family leave and monetary, you know, the banking regulators. Well, I want to take a look at a couple other things before we run out of time today. This video has popped up. It's been going viral around the net. About something, I think it happened a couple years ago, where Anthony Fauci and I think it was Muriel Bowser, the mayor of Washington, D.C., were wandering the streets. They were walking around trying to encourage people to take the quote-unquote vaccine, the one that's not legally a vaccine. And, they had some homes where they found some resistance.
They're not doing it because they say they don't want to do it. They're Republicans. They don't like to be told what to do.
Right.
And we got to break that, you know, unpack that.
So what do we see? We see people that are hesitant to take the drug, the biological, the experimental treatment that Fauci and Bowser are promoting. And the last thing they want is for people to not follow them, to not blindly do whatever they're told. Now, it's interesting because Dr. Fauci says that by not submitting to the coercion of the injection, they're going to keep the outbreak smoldering in the country. Well, sorry, sir. Not only is the evidence wrong now, the evidence was wrong then. First of all, there is absolutely zero evidence that the shot stops the spread of COVID. Doesn't work. See, originally I said it was going to stop the spread. You wouldn't get infected. It would stop the spread. It failed because they never tested it for that. Then they said, well, it'll make you won't get as sick, which of course is very, very helpful because how do you prove the counterfactual? If you get COVID and you're only X amount of sick, all they can do is, well, you would have been twice as bad if you hadn't taken the shot, and there's no way to prove otherwise. Then again, there's no way to prove that they're right. But they simply assume because they're part of government that the assumption that they're right. Well, I think we need to break that idea. See, I assume government has to prove they're right before I believe them. I know, I'm weird. People don't think that way anymore. I do. And I'm encouraging more and more people to look around and say, does government get the benefit of the doubt or do the people get the benefit of the doubt? Because now, sir, the evidence is in. The outbreak isn't smoldering because people won't take your shot. We're seeing more and more damage. The number of reports in VAERS, in even in their own internal reporting system for the vaccine, far exceeds other vaccines that were pulled for less. Over 1.5 million adverse events reported to VAERS. Almost 35,000 reported deaths from this vaccine. But it also misses a very simple concept. If the vaccine was that good, why do you have to coerce people to take it? How about this other vaccine? The HPV vaccine. We were told, oh, this is wonderful. This will prevent the spread of cervical cancer. There's just one problem. The data never said that. See, they failed to tell you there are over 200 strains of the human papillomavirus, at least that we know of now. And of these, about 40 of them can cause cancer. And the most common cancer is cervical cancer, at least related to HPV infections. Now, the first vaccine that was released, it was licensed, was Gardasil, except it was only effective against 4 HPV strains, not the 40 that caused 4. Now, against those 4, Gardasil was effective. There was an 88% decline among young ladies 14 to 19 years old, and 81% among women 20 to 24 years old. So that sounds great, but the rest of the story. See, between 2001 and 2018, cervical cancer rates have been increasing by about 1.3% per year. Now, some of you may be saying, Paul, you just said that those 4 strains have been going down. Yeah, most of these cancers appear to be associated with strains that are not covered by the vaccine. But it gets worse. See, there's evidence to suggest that the vaccination actually makes women more susceptible to than their non-vaccinated peers for the types of HPV that are not covered by the vaccine. Meaning of the 40, if you get the vaccine, you do much better on those 4, but you're more likely to get a cancer from one of the other strains. And again, I'm not a biologist. I'm not a doctor. But I remember government pushing this. I remember our daughter being the doctors, because the CDC was pushing this, and the FDA was pushing this, pushed hard for her to get this vaccine, and we refused. Even just a few years ago, they pressured us to have her vaccinated, and they pressured her to be vaccinated, and she refused. Now I'm looking at it going, that's probably not a half bad idea. Now, what about some other things? How about fiscal policy, right? We see Elizabeth Warren, Senator Warren, was on Meet the Press a week or so ago. And she's very upset with the Federal Reserve's intent to continue to raise interest rates. She says it's extraordinary and extreme because they're raising interest rates right after, or they're planning to raise interest rates right after the failure of two major banks, Silicon Valley Bank and Signature Bank. Now, this senator, again, politician, never worked in the banking industry as far as I know, has two reasons for it. She said the first is to remind Chairman, she wanted to remind Chairman Powell that he has dual mandate. Yes, he is responsible for dealing with inflation, but he is also responsible for employment. All right, well, there's problem number one. See, the federal government has no authority to deal with inflation, much less a responsibility to control employment. And look at what happened. Now, the federal government created the Federal Reserve, gave them this illegal mandate, and look what's happened. Now, I don't just mean the recent inflation. I mean the decades-long inflation that has devalued the dollar. The bubbles that have been created by Fed policy, by interest rates and others. So again, I'm old enough to remember the 70s, the malaise, the misery index. I remember the dot-com bust. I remember the housing collapse. And each one of those can be linked directly to some Fed policy. Now, by the way, this is the same Elizabeth Warren who's calling it extreme. She says that the Congress has a constitutional duty to raise the debt ceiling. I'd invite her to read the Constitution. Tell me where that comes from. Because the problem isn't the debt ceiling. The debt ceiling is a symptom of the fact that Congress, which, by the way, Senator Warren is a part of, can't spend, they cannot manage money. They have no clue how to manage money. Now, individually, they may. Collectively, I wouldn't trust these people with a piggy bank. And then this senator has the gall to tell the Federal Reserve how to fulfill their mandate. Not looking at the fact that SVB didn't collapse because Fed raised the interest rate. That was the trigger that set off their bad management. SVB mismanaged their assets. They did not prepare for the possibility that interest rates would go up, even as the signals were there for more than a year or two. They did not prepare. Therefore, it's not the Fed's problem that SVB collapsed. The Federal Reserve doesn't control inflation. It doesn't control employment. It usually what it does is how hard is it going to discourage employment and the economy in order to get inflation under control? And how badly is it going to discourage, to encourage inflation in order to get the employment numbers up? Federal Reserve is a political nightmare. And it's making a mess of our economy in large part because of its policies, because the federal government is asking you to do things they had no legal authority to do. And if you want some more information, I suggest look through your favorite video service, look for Thomas Sowell and his explanation. He's an award-winning economist, brilliant man, and look at how he describes the policies and how they've impacted the economy. Now, I've got one more area I want to consider before we call it a day today, and that is basic law enforcement. Now, the federal government has very little legal authority when it comes to law enforcement outside of federally owned property, like, well, say, the District of Columbia. See, over the last few years, we've had a couple of, well, riots. Right? Back in 2020, we had multiple riots hit Washington, D.C. And then, of course, you had January 6th, which, okay, yeah, part of it was a riot. I don't know that I'd go so far. I wouldn't go so far as a riot, but a lot of people call it a riot. Okay. So let's take a look. How much time and effort did the FBI put in during the January 6th riots and the riots during 2020? Well, the Oversight Project got access to some payroll records. Not the details, but hours worked. And you know what they found? See, during the pay period, which included January 6th, from January 4th to January 17th, 2021, that they worked about 86,262 man hours were worked. Now, compare that to May 25th through June 7th of 2020, when the BLM riots hit D.C., they worked about 70,367 hours. So here we have two-week periods, both of which encompassed a riot. What was being called a riot, whether you agree with January 6th, is being called a riot. And it appears a significant more time was spent by the FBI at the January 6th riot than at the BLM riots. What does that tell us? What can we glean from this? Why would the FBI spend 20% more manpower and hours worked on the January 6th event than the 2021 riot and the 2020 riot? Now, I'm reading an article from the Daily Signal where I first found this, and I would think between that and Oversight Project, well, they want you to believe that it was a political thing. And that may be true. Right. It may be that those at power in power at the FBI saw the people demonstrating against what they saw as corruption in the elections to be much more dangerous, therefore require much more manpower than simple, you know, rioting in the streets by Black Lives Matter. That is an absolute possibility. It could also be that seeing that January 6th happened after the BLM riots, the FBI learned something, and they learned that maybe they need to engage more manpower when these types of events come up. That may be because, understand, you know, during BLM, we had arson and vandalism. We even had vandalism going on right outside the White House to the point where the Secret Service put the president in the bunker because they were afraid that these rioters are going to storm the White House. Right? It didn't happen, but there was that concern. So I look at this and I say, I don't know yet. This to me is evidence, but it's not proof. I'm sure there are plenty of people on the net that are going to be talking about how this is proof that this is political and one-sided and that BLM can get away with vandalism. But, you know, you question an election where a Democrat won and you're going to jail. I don't think it shows that, at least not directly. I think a better example is, where are the BLM rioters that were put in jail, that were put in solitary confinement, that had restricted access to their attorneys, that were charged with disrupting government? I don't see them. But it does bring to question a possibility of the other reason why governments screw everything up. Because everything a government does is political. From your county to the federal government, everything becomes politics. Everything becomes about party, about position, about votes, and about the next election. And everything becomes collectivist. Everything comes down to, as a collective, we don't deal in government, you don't deal with individuals. You deal with groups. You deal with collectives. It's the depersonalization that is part of the reason that the governments screw everything up. So remember the words of Ronald Reagan.
I think you all know that I've always felt the 9 most terrifying words in the English language are, I'm from the government and I'm here to help.
Yes, that should scare each and every one of us. What should scare us more is when we go begging to government to help us. It never seems to work out well, at least not in the long term. There might be some short-term gains, some short-term benefits. But we're supposed to be a free people. We're supposed to be an independent people. And shouldn't that mean, whenever possible, we figure things out for ourselves? That we only go to government when there's really no other choice. There's no other logical way to do it. And then when we do ask government to do things for us, we make sure they are bound down with unbreakable chains of limitations. It's what the Constitution was supposed to do. Sadly, we have unlocked those chains and refused to put them back on government. Because of that, a lot of our problems can trace their responsibility in part back to somebody at government saying, I'm here to help. So as you look at all the times some government actor, some bureaucrat, some politician says, I'm going to do this, I'm here because I'm here to help, I hope it scares you to death. Now I hope you join me every weekday at 4 p.m. Eastern Time for the Constitution Study on America Out Loud Talk Radio, heard on the iHeartRadio Network. You can also listen to the podcast on your favorite podcast app. But do me a favor, subscribe, rate the show, leave me a review. It helps other people find the Constitution Study as well. You can find all the links at the homepage right there at AmericaOutloud.com. But don't keep them to yourself. Please share them. Share them far, share them wide. And by doing so, you're helping to share the blessings of liberty.